When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
This season of Desert Island Dishes is sponsored by Maldon Salt, the finest natural sea salt flakes handcrafted from the British coastline. They are, quite frankly, the masters of salt, putting craft, care, and passion into everything they do. You only have to read one of my recipes to know that I use Maldon Salt every single day for all of my cooking. To say I am a fan is an understatement, so to be working with them this season is a dream come true. I'm often asked about the secret to getting better at cooking, and my answer is honestly always the same. It comes down to seasoning, and not just as an afterthought. You have to season at every stage, and that's why I love Maldon Salt. It's light and delicate due to the soft and crunchy pyramid-shaped flakes, and it's just the easiest way to take simple dishes to the next level. Trust me, your cooking life will not be the same. Thank you very much to Maldon Salt. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, how are you all? I cannot believe that since this season started, we have been at the top of the charts for all food podcasts in the UK, which that might sound like I'm boasting, and that's not how I mean it at all. I mean it more just as an overwhelming thank you to you for listening. I know as a listener, it won't mean very much, but Desert Island Dishes is one of the only podcasts in the top of the charts that's completely independent. I don't have a huge team or a huge marketing budget or the ability to do a big PR campaign. It's just me and my amazing producer week after week. So really, it's down to you listening and helping to spread the word by telling people to listen. And so for that, I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. We have a brilliant guest for you today. Matt is a fantastic pastry chef, and I really loved hearing the story of how he got to where he is today. His Instagram, I really think, is one of the funniest I follow. He's so honest in his stories of getting his recipes just right. I think often cooking doesn't go right first time. It goes wrong, and that's part of the fun in learning how you rectify it. But I think when it's your job, somehow you want to portray that everything is perfect and you don't want to show a weakness. And Matt really shows that the opposite is true, because it's so relatable and always makes me laugh. I don't think he'll mind me saying that. This one, I should say, gets a little controversial when we get into the topic of sandwiches. I wonder what side you'll be on. Anyway, without further ado, here is today's episode. My guest today is Matt Adlard. Matt is a self-taught baker, author, and social media pastry sensation. You may have known him in the early days online as the Topless Baker, and he's known for hosting his own show on the Food Network, as well as being a judge on various different baking shows, including the BBC's Platinum Pudding Competition. Despite growing up above his father's Michelin-starred restaurant, Matt said he had little interest in pursuing a career in food and fell into baking as a hobby while studying at university. University. He is entirely self-taught and now teaches his millions of followers how to become a professional level baker through his videos and courses. He has an online cooking school called Bake It Better and published his first book last year with the same name. Welcome, Matt.
That was really fantastic, I do have to say. I couldn't have done it better myself. Well,
that's very good to know. We're off to a good start.
It's very accurate, yeah. Above the restaurant too. That was impressive.
But I feel a little bit silly because I've been following you for a while now on social media. And it was only when I was researching this interview that I made the connection that you are the topless baker.
The original, the yes. OG.
Is there another one?
Well, I think nowadays everyone's topless, like on TikTok and... You know, QCP, if you don't have heard of QCP, he's a great creator that cooks topless in his beautiful LA home. And I was the OG, guys. I was the OG, but I probably should have kept my top on because they are so successful. And if I just carried on going to the gym and being topless, I probably wouldn't have gained.
Well, how did the idea come about?
Wow, okay, this is really throwing it back. So I used to be obsessed with the gym when I was sort of 16, you know, 16 plus, and just eat chicken and brown rice and broccoli and didn't eat any sugar basically, and started to bake as a slight hobby, like you said, from university. And we had a bake-off competition at the office during Great British Bake Off, so everyone got a different week, and I entered my lemon tart, which I'll probably go on and on and on about my lemon tart, and I won. And
Matt, are you rubbing this in my face because of the story?
I know, I didn't want to bring that up earlier. You did tell me how you lost the bake-off, but I did win my bake-off. I was in this office, you know, blow-torching my lemon tart right above the fire alarm and scared that I was going to evacuate 1,000 people. And this girl said, "You're pretty good at baking and you probably look good naked. You should do the naked baker." And I was like, well, that's really inappropriate, but I could do it topless. So I just Googled topless baker. No, you know, the website was free, the handles were free. There was one guy in, I think, China who'd done like a topless video that had made it to the Daily Mail. And I thought, this is a USP. I'm never going to kind of cut it as just Matt Adlard. So I'll try the topless baker. And that was how it started.
That's so interesting because I was thinking, you know, when you're starting out, it is quite nerve-wracking and hard to put yourself out there on the internet, and it makes you feel very vulnerable. But I wondered whether, I mean, at first...
Being so naked made it even better.
No, but I wondered, like, obviously at first glance, being topless seems like the scariest way of doing it. But in a way, it was having a personality or a character that you could hide behind. And conversely, did that make it seem less scary, or was that not remotely part of it?
I can't remember it being scary. I think I remember because I started with live streaming, so I didn't start YouTube or Instagram. There was a platform called Meerkat. That was the big thing at the time. I knew I could never make it on YouTube or Facebook. That was too late to the game. I mean, this is back in 2015 maybe, so I wasn't really too late to the game in hindsight.
You're pretty early.
Yeah, but at the time, you know, everyone was talking about live streaming, so I was like, great, I'll be the Jamie Oliver of live streaming. And so I think going live was nerve-wracking, and I think it was quite disheartening that, you know, I think my first lesson was how to make pasta. It wasn't sweet treats, and I think I had 4 people watch me, one of which probably being my girlfriend, my now wife at the time, sitting in the bedroom watching me go live. And so that was disheartening because I was really trying to engage, but, you know, there's no comments coming through, no one's watching. But then the next week... 100 people tuned in, and that's like, you know, that's a little taste of fame there. You're like, oh, okay, you know. And the week after that, 1,000 people tuning in, and that was when I was like, okay, you know, I was really comfortable doing it. I enjoyed the gimmicky nature of the toplessness. You know, I was pretty muscly, so I felt pretty comfortable with my apron on. So yeah, it was fun. I didn't take it seriously. It's not like someone starting out on social media today where they start for it to be a career. It was very much a joke. It was a bit of fun. It was going to be a website to store my recipes. It was not about making money, becoming a better baker, none of that at all. It was just purely out of fun.
It's hard to remember that now because obviously the landscape has changed so much, but it was so different then and people weren't making careers out of it, which is hard to imagine now, but it just was a totally different thing.
Yeah, and I think I remember watching... you know, Zoella, one of the originals, and just thinking like, wow, these guys have made it. You know, they're so established. Everything has been completely covered on the internet. And, you know, little did you know, there was just so much more to come. And I guess in my head, it was saturated. It was over. Mm. Every apple crumble recipe had been made. Yeah, the toplessness was just a fun way to cut through, I guess, and be slightly different. So it was, I mean, I need to write to this person, whoever made it. There was a company called Food Insider. It's like part of Business Insider. Yeah. They do a Food Insider. And they did a video that was kind of like a compilation of some of my YouTube videos, like this heartthrob baker is making like sexy French desserts on the internet. And they were like really good at like putting my handles and saying what my name was. And it just, people just looked me up and it exploded, you know, Instagram 50K, YouTube, you know, 70K. And this is literally within 12, 14 hours. It was mind-blowing.
Your father was a Michelin-starred chef and you grew up above his restaurant, so I am very intrigued to know the answer to the first desert island dish, and that is the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
This is an answer that I will give for the rest of my career, and it's lemon tart. Mm. So I sort of spoke about it earlier as the first thing I ever learned to bake, and it was my dad's sort of famous dessert, and whenever we would have dinner or, you know, it was a nice evening, we'd always have lemon tart. Dad was famous for making his lemon tart. And so that for me is the most nostalgic dessert. To this day, you know, we'll go to my dad's and say, "Dad, will you make lemon tart?" It's something I will teach my kids. It's something I'll teach my nieces. Like, it is a tradition for our family. Like, everyone has to know how to make lemon tart. So I am obsessed with that recipe. I think it is the best lemon tart. I mean, I've tried a lot of famous recipes, and this is elite in my opinion. So it's very special to me, that recipe.
What makes it so special?
It's just so simple, you know. It's like beautifully thin pastry. It's a really tart but sweet, perfectly set lemon filling. You know, there's no meringue, he sometimes blowtorch, but no blowtorch, like no creams, no, it's just pure perfection. There's nowhere to hide because you've got to have good pastry, you've got to have a good lemon filling. It's the perfect balance of sweetness, tartness, yeah.
But he wasn't a pastry chef, was he?
Not really. He could bake, and, you know, I would say if I went to my dad now and said, "Hey, Dad, could you make me a cookie?" He'd have absolutely no idea. No, you know.
But he did a stage at the Connaught, didn't he?
He did, yes. So I was just at the Connaught earlier and I was saying I'd love to come back with him. Yeah, he's definitely got experience in pastry, but that was not his forte by any means. But
so it kind of makes it even more amazing that that's like his signature dish.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know where he got the recipe. Like, I want to know where he stole it from, because, you know, baking is like a series of like theft of different recipes from different people. So I'm always like, where did you get that? He's like, there's obviously a secret as to where he's got that from. I'm thinking it's probably from the back in the days of the Connaught, but it's just been slowly adapted, I say, like over the years. And I've taken his recipe and adapted it. And I'm hoping, like, you know, if my kids are into baking, they're going to like elevate it slightly. So I'm excited to see like the way it transitions.
Yeah, that's amazing when that happens with families, yeah, like through the generations. So growing up with a father who was such a successful chef, I think you've said that that actually put you off wanting to go into the world of food because you saw firsthand quite how hard it was.
I mean, he always said to me, like, "Matthew, never be a chef."
Oh, did he?
Yeah, always. It was not something he pushed. You know, when I went to university, I'd never cooked before. You know, I had no cooking skills. It wasn't something we did in the kitchen together. Obviously, I'd eaten well and experienced nice food, but it wasn't a passion of mine. You know, he works so late, so hard. Today, there's a lot of fanfare for Michelin star food. There's a lot of excitement. People will go out of their way to travel to spend money. Back in the day, you know, that wasn't really a thing. It was just an expensive, you know, it was something a very elite group of people would go and do. And so I think he produced beautiful food and was a great personality, but was just a little bit kind of too soon for the Michelin star world. And so I saw how hard he works and I thought, yeah, I'm not interested in that at all. So it was far, far from what I wanted to do.
That's interesting. So you didn't grow up cooking at home, presumably because he was so busy always cooking at the restaurant when he was at home. Perhaps that was the last thing he felt like doing.
I don't remember him ever using his free time to enjoy cooking. There was never that sort of relaxing. And it's same with me. I don't bake in my free time to enjoy it. You know, it's always for work. So I never saw him doing that. And my parents were separated. So, you know, we'd spend time with mum and we live right around the corner from each other. So, you know, food wasn't it was just a sustenance almost, you know, and he'd be working the nights we might go there. So, yeah, it wasn't a big part of our life in terms of outside of the restaurant and eating.
That's so interesting that you say for both him and yourself that it's not something that you do, like, out of pure pleasure. Do you think part of that now for you is... does it kind of feel like a wasted opportunity if you're not filming it and you're not writing it down?
I guess when I make something, I also expect perfection. So if I'm like, oh, I'll do some bacon with my son, I'm like,
oh,
no, you need to weigh these eggs properly, you know. Like,
with your son, isn't he three?
Yeah, but I like really take control, and that's where I'm too controlling about the perfection that I can't relax into it. And, you know, when you've got young kids, it's chaos in the house. You know, there isn't that kind of zen moment to be like, okay, I'm just going to make like a beautiful focaccia. Pizza, I'd say pizza is my, I love making pizza and have a lovely pizza oven. So that's my slight thing I bake to enjoy food and just to be a little bit more relaxed, but never fine pastry or like a nice little chocolate cake.
And one of the things I was wondering was, you know, maybe that was like a dream that your dad harbored, that you would take over the restaurant one day, but obviously that is the opposite advice that he gave you. What does he think of what you're doing now?
Yeah, I think about it a lot, actually, that, you know, the point you made about taking it over, and I think, gosh, if just 15 years later, like what a duo we could have been. Like, that is, makes me sad that we could never kind of team up and do that together, because his energy, his personality is like another level, something that's just, he's great to be around. And so I'm sad we kind of missed that opportunity. But yeah, he's older, he doesn't understand social media. And so for him, you know, if I'm traveling for work, I get to go to America, or you know, I might get paid for something, and he is just gobsmacked at, you know, the opportunities that I get. And not that they're crazy, but, you know, in the past when I was doing a lot of TV, you know, I went to LA and they flew me first class and that kind of stuff. When you're 24 and that's your son, he's 24, must be mind-blowing. I mean, I don't get that today by any means, no way, but I think for him it's amazing. And I quite like that he's not really a baker, so I don't feel intimidated by him looking at my stuff or trying my stuff, because I know he can't do it.
That would be very stressful.
Yeah.
So I know that you've said you didn't pick up a wooden spoon until your early 20s, but let's talk about the second desert island dish, and that's the first dish you learnt to cook.
I'm not sure this counts. Like I said, I went to university, and it was funny because my dad, being the chef, we went to Nesbitt's, and he got me like a suitcase of knives. So, like, you know, that Vogue set where you get like, you know, the paring knife and the fish knife and the, you know, not that I'd ever filleted fish before, the butcher's knife, all this whole set. And so I remember walking into the university kitchen and kind of sliding this suitcase on the table and opening it up, and everyone being like, wow, like, this guy must be able to cook. And honestly, the first meal, because I don't think I'd ever cooked a meal for myself. The first meal I learned to make was frozen fish fillet with frozen chips. I mean, I don't know if this counts for the question, but genuinely, I couldn't cook. I'm not even sure I'd made a pasta sauce or chopped an onion. I genuinely can't remember having learned that. So literally cooking a frozen meal was the first dish
I think that's, especially at university, I think that's many people's experience. I'm just so interested in that being your answer, with your dad being who he is.
Yeah, I'm really trying hard to think, like, could I really, I don't even think I made meat, beans on toast. You know, I genuinely don't think I'd ever cooked a full meal before. And I don't know how I learned, because I can cook now, like, not, I'm not amazing, but I can definitely get by. And yeah, I don't know how. I had a really great housemate who was a good cook, and so I remember her teaching me how to chop and use my fancy knives.
I love the thought of you unrolling the knife.
It really was
that
moment.
To cook your frozen fish.
It was like, it looked like it was going to hold like a pistol or something. It was like a plastic suitcase that, like, also, with a foam padding. It was,
I can just imagine all of your, like, roommates being so excited. Like, yes, we're with the guy. He's got his own knives.
And especially then, in hindsight of how bad they were at cooking. I mean, some stories about, what the things they did was, scars me to this day.
We all have to learn somehow, though, don't we?
Yeah. I think putting your cooked chili con carne in the cupboard instead of the fridge was a dangerous move by the housemate. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't sound great.
Still entertains me to this day.
So what is it about baking that you love so much? Because it is quite a unique thing. It's a science, but it's as creative as an art. You are, I think, a perfectionist. So is it the precision that you really love?
Absolutely. I love the accuracy, because it's like a formula. Not that I was ever good at maths or science.
Well, I was going to ask that. Were you not?
I was really into business and advertising and marketing and that kind of stuff. I think I have this perfectionist element to me by all means, and I think my dad had that, but I never knew about that until way later in life. Not even school, I think I looked at things in that light. But I love the accuracy of, right, if I follow XYZ, it should turn out like that. Like, there's no room for error. Mm. Whereas with cooking, you're a bit pinch of this, pinch of that. I love saying 3.5 grams of salt, not 4, 3.5. And I just follow the same thing over and over again because I know it's going to come out the same every time. So I love that precision, but also the creativity, like the spin you can put on things. I think baking is quite mundane and people recreate the same milfoy and the same eclair and the same shoe bun. And I love just being like, right, I'm so bored of that. What can I do that is a different shape, you know, anything. I'm just like, what colour can I add? What texture? And it might be weird. Some, you know, a lot of them turn out slightly odd and they're things I dream up that just really don't pan out. But a lot of them are cool and creative and fun and people take inspiration from them. And I love being different, whether that's like in an annoying way or like a fun way. I really like trying to stand out, basically. And baking is a great vessel to do that.
I feel like you're the Willy Wonka of pastry.
Yeah, I kind of call, there's a guy called Amari Gouchon, which you probably will know. He makes up the giant chocolate giraffes and stuff. Yeah. I kind of call myself like the dollar store version of him. Because he's like, I'm really good friends with him, and I've been to his pastry academy in Las Vegas, and just what he creates and his vision is another level. Yeah. And so I'm like, I like what he does, but I'm the dollar store version.
I don't think you're
the
dollar
like
store
that.
Version. I think you're the British version.
The pound man. Yeah.
No. Because you love precision so much, what do you think about metric measurements versus imperial? Why do we all have a different way of measuring things for baking? What's that about?
Yeah, I wrote my first book and it was a big discussion because I was with an American publisher. Mm. And the first call I said, just so you know, guys, I'm going to write this book in grams. And they're like, ooh, okay, could we have a conversion chart? And I said, I'm not writing this if you put a conversion chart in, because page one is going to be get a scale and measure everything accurately. And it just comes back to this point of like science, the science of baking and everything. If you use the same amount of flour, eggs and butter, your recipe is going to turn out pretty much the same 98% of the time. And there's so many variables in baking that using cups and teaspoons and ounces, it just it's adding too many variables where you're going to be really inconsistent. And baking is so disheartening, you know, when you get something wrong and it's expensive, eggs, butter, sugar, cream, and you mess it up and you just think, oh, I can't believe I've just like wasted all that time. And I do it all the time, but just removing that element of inaccuracy by using scales is a game changer.
But why is that a thing? Like, why do we all do it differently?
I don't know.
Like, where did the cups come from?
I mean, it is easy, right? Yeah. There's that lovely French yogurt pot cake where you do like
that.
A cup of yogurt and a cup, you know, I don't actually know the recipe, but it works out beautifully and you get this lovely yogurt cake. But again, for me, there's that convenience of it, which is brilliant. And that's a nice way, I think, for people to get into baking. But if you do it for convenience and it goes wrong, you're probably then going to stop baking. You're like, oh, that cookie recipe is wrong. I used the cups and it was impossible. And so I think it can damage people's confidence, which is not great.
I know that you've said that you really don't like being bad at things, which I mean, I think most people don't like being bad at things, but you really hate failing. But when I was reading about your career, have you had anything that hasn't worked out?
I mean, My whole career is failure, to be honest. I mean, you laugh, but because I'm self-taught, I've never been to a course, I've never taken an online course, I've never had my dad sit down and tell me how to make something. And so I learn through failing. Mm. So, I mean, I could list countless things I'd bore you to death. Just everything I try usually is a failure to start. Now, I'm lucky enough in a position now where I have a lot of followers, I have a lot of friends who are the best in their industries, the best sourdough bakers, the best chocolatiers. And so if I need help or advice, I have a really good kind of network of people to go to. But when I started, when I was topless making pasta live, I had no idea how to make macarons. And I remember making my first croissant and being like, that's pretty good. And I look at the picture now and I think, you didn't even know like You didn't know about flours and butter and temperatures and laminate. Like, you were just really happy with what you made, but wow, that was so bad. So yeah, failure is a really important thing for me. I love that it's part of my kind of USP. I love showing people that I fail. I enjoy, I wish I got it right every time, I'm not gonna lie. I'd like to never fail, but I love the success of overcoming a failure and being like, I did it. I worked it out. No one else helped me. I did it.
I always think that's very generous because you are quite famous on Instagram for showing the behind the scenes, showing the versions that didn't work.
Yep.
And I think that's actually a very generous thing to do because it's showing that that happens to everyone and it's part of the process. That is cooking, that is baking. And confidence is the key. So, you know, you're going to fail one time, you're going to do it again and it hopefully will work the next time. I think that's very generous.
Yeah, and people love that, you know, that I get messages daily from people being like, just want to say, like, I love how transparent you are. And you show that, you know, they look at me and they say, you are the best. And that's lovely. I don't think I am by any means, but they, you know, they'll say, you're amazing. And it's so good to see that you fail or you suck. You know, I made a wedding cake just last week and it was a whole saga on my Instagram about how I basically cheated making the wedding cake because I just physically couldn't do it. And they loved that they said, you know, wow, you made a beautiful wedding cake, but the fact you told us it was made out of styrofoam and card is so honest. Like, I could have told them it was tempered chocolate and it was all filled and layered. And but, you know, why hide the truth? That will inspire someone that says, actually, next time I'm making a wedding cake, I'm going to use styrofoam too. And I'm just going to cut loads of different sizes of cakes. And it's just giving people ideas and, yeah, not being scared to fail because they look at someone that's so good. I tell my friends all the time, like, the influencer friends, like, show people that you're failing or you suck.
Or show people that you're a real person.
Yeah.
But I think it's this whole idea of online perfection and wanting everyone to think that you're perfect. But nobody is perfect. So we all know straight off the bat that can't be true.
Yeah.
And therefore, how can you connect with someone who isn't really real?
And sometimes it can be hard to kind of visualize that, you know. I have conversations all the time, you know, how can you turn that? How can you turn that into a series? Or how can you... And it's like, I don't want it to, I want it to be off the cuff. Like,
I don't want to be known as the person who fails.
And I say, oh, could that be a show? Or could you make a series about it? I'm like, it just happens, you know. Imagine watching 3 minutes where just everything goes wrong. And then at the end,
something
goes right. I know. I'm like, how do I stitch that together? But I love how kind of off the cuff the nature of it is. It does encourage a lot of, like, I call them backseat bakers. Like, no, you should have done this. No, you know, my granny, she does it like this. I'm like, okay, right, well, that's really helpful. That was actually 8 hours ago I posted that story. I've already burnt it, so thanks for telling me that now. So I get a little bit tetchy in my DMs of some people, like, telling me, like, what it should be, and I'm like, I just don't respond. But yeah, generally I'm quite nice. I appreciate people's support.
We're on to the third desert island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
This is going to be a funny one, actually, and I was thinking through this because it was back... in my TV career back in the day, kind of pre-COVID, I did a lot of TV in America. And I can't believe I'm saying this is the best thing I've eaten, but we went, it was the final stage of a TV show called Chopped. I don't know if you've ever been on, heard of Chopped before, but they basically get given a mystery basket of ingredients and they have, you know, 15 minutes, then 30 minutes, and then 45 minutes to make, you know, different desserts. And this was a sweet episode. And so it was the final round and it was this French pastry chef from, you know, Wisconsin or something, you know, middle of America. And they got given chai spiced latte mix. They got given egg whites and they got given chicken. Okay, and they had to make a dessert out of this dish.
With chicken?
Chicken, yeah. So this guy makes an île flottant, which is like a poached meringue in a chai custard. With a crispy salted chicken skin on top. And it was mind-blowing because it was like salty, sweet, spicy. And I was eating this like, oh my goodness. Like, he's made this in 45 minutes with random ingredients. But the combination was unbelievable. And the way he was able to put that together in the time with those ingredients, in those circumstances, I was like, this is amazing. And I was truly blown away by that dish. So, il flottant with chicken skin.
We've never had that answer before.
No, no. And I genuinely, at the time, I was just like, how do I react to this on camera? Because it was genuinely that good.
Were you worried before you tasted it?
He'd done so well in the previous round. You know, he knew, you know, he'd made a flexible ganache in another round. I was like, this guy, he knows what he's doing. So I felt good about what he was going to come out with. But it was like, you know, the way he styled it, he, you know, he'd made the Il Flottone in like a ring. So it was a beautiful disc of meringue with this, he'd picked the plate perfectly and the chicken skin was just a shard. It was like Heston Blumenthal, you know, just this shard of chicken skin and just cracking into it. And it was, yeah, it was wonderful.
Wow. Yeah, sounds amazing.
Brings me some good memories.
So you did genuinely teach yourself everything you know by watching YouTube videos and videos on social media, which I think is kind of amazing and full circle when you think about it now, because that is now the medium that you are teaching people how to cook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm a very observant person. I say, you know, if you speak to my wife, she'll say, when we go to a cafe, I sit looking out to the road and I'll just soak up as much information as I can. We won't speak, and then 5 minutes in, I'll be like, oh, you'll never guess what this couple have just said. And this guy walked past and he's seen that. I just love like absorbing as much information as I can. But it's the same thing with baking and social media. Like I use that Instagram save feature, like a digital notebook. Like I'll look at posts I saved 4 years ago and I'll come back to them. But right, I'm going to use that design and this color and this recipe, and then I'll just kind of merge it together in my dreams. Usually, I'll just go to bed and dream about what I'm going to make.
Really? Is yeah. That's how it happens?
Yeah, so it's not drawing it, or I'll go to sleep, and as soon as my head hits the pillow, I'll be like, bing, right, I'm thinking about this.
Were you ever interested in going to a restaurant and learning in that way?
My dad would always say, there's a very famous chef in Norfolk called Richard Bainbridge. He's a beautiful restaurant. And he's like, you need to do a week at Richard's restaurant. But I thought, in a restaurant, you know, they just make the same thing over and over again. Not saying it wouldn't be good, but like, once I've made their tart, it's like, okay, well, like, what next? And that's what I love about social media, is I don't have to follow a script. I can do what I want. And so I think, for me, I would love to go train in bread. I think that's probably like my slight weakness, sourdough. I would love to go and train somewhere to learn about that. Yeah, the idea of just like repetition on something doesn't instill me with excitement.
And also you're putting someone else's vision to life, which like, it sounds like for you, the creativity and the vision is such a big part of it. Mm. I don't know if you'd enjoy making someone else's.
Yeah, and I think I struggle a little bit with the imposter syndrome of like these guys in restaurants or bakeries, they've obviously trained, they've been there a long time, they do it a certain way. You know, I come in this frilly influencer, all energetic with my phone out, and they're just like, no, I'm not on board with this. Not that, you know, I try not to be too influencery ever, but I think there's kind of that jarring clash of very traditional pastry chefs and this kind of like bubbly, annoying influencer. And I think, I wonder if we would just clash. It would have to be a friend that like knows me well and knows like I'm fairly grounded and I wouldn't annoy them too much.
You're not remotely annoying, but is that true that you do worry that your skills wouldn't match up to what they were in the restaurant, even after all this time?
I definitely worry about that.
Really?
Even writing the book, I just think someone might pick this up, a pastry chef, someone, an expert, and they say, oh, that brioche recipe is not right. Or, you know, he hasn't done this properly. Because again, I want to be the best. Mm. I want to be this self-taught baker who has taught himself how to be the best. And so I kind of, you know, I want to just be that quiet guy that, wow, actually it's really, really impressive what he's creating. And yeah, I just kind of worry about them knowing how it should be done right and judging me and saying, you know, you've missed this and missed that. And I want it to be perfect every time. If I'm mowing the lawn, making a cocktail, whatever it is, like I want to do it to the best of my ability.
I mean, I think everyone has that worry, whether you'd been professionally trained or not. It's a constant learning process. And I think that worry would be there even if you'd done it completely differently.
Yeah, it's like, who am I looking for validation from? I wonder, do I need that? Is that validation going to somehow make me feel better? You know, probably not. I think it's also, I don't sell my goods. You know, you don't have a customer saying, wow, that is the best, whatever. You don't have like a daily affirmation of what you're making being good. So people say, oh, do you sell your goods? Do you sell your tarts? I'm like, no, like my neighbors try them, and if they tell me it's bad, they never receive another baked good again. So it's kind of, you have to tell me, or my ego is very fragile, so you have to tell me that it's good.
Oh my goodness, I love that. Matt, we're on to the most important question of the day. It's the fourth desert island dish. What is your favorite sandwich?
I love this because I'm so basic. Like, I grew up the most beige eater ever. And so it would be a tiger baguette, so like a tiger topping baguette with chicken mayo.
Oh, yes. Okay,
like a poached chicken breast with Hellmann's mayonnaise. That's it. Salt and pepper. Like that, literally. Or a ham and cheese sandwich. But I'd go like a slightly warm chicken mayo sandwich is my dream. It's like seriously nostalgic. I remember my mum making them, like that slightly soft tiger bread. Oh, yeah. Could do that right now.
Are you doing butter?
No. Oh, my wife does this. Butter and then mayo. That is
crazy. I mean, Matt, that's your crazy. Wife does that because that is the right way of doing it.
No.
What do you mean?
No, the mayo's doing enough. That's the moistener. That's the fat.
Right, Matt, we were getting on so well. And
okay,
now...
I'm out. So, you know, no cheese, no ham, no cucumber.
Are you mixing the chicken with the mayo or are these going in different layers?
So I think, yeah, I'd dice the chicken. So it'd be poached chicken, dice it, yeah, get it in a bowl, stir it through with some mayo, little taste, salt and pepper if you're feeling fancy, but probably pepper. and that's it. You know, you're not poaching the chicken breast in stock or with any spices. No. It's going to come out beige. And I want it to be so beige. So that's what I'm going to eat. Because it holds up as well. When you get it in cling film, there's no cucumber in there going soggy. It's going to hold up. Just that moistness is just going to expand. It's going to elevate. Oh, yeah. Wow. Feeling good about it.
What are your thoughts on crisps and sandwiches?
No. I think on the side. Walker's
really?
Cheese and onion on the side.
Okay.
Any kind of sour cream crisp on the side. Not in there, no.
Okay, you feel quite strongly about
that.
Yeah,
very strongly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. A sandwich is a sandwich.
Matt, again, you're wrong, but that's okay.
That's fine. I'm here to debate it.
So after university, you worked in advertising, but you were working really hard behind the scenes on your blog and trying to turn your passion into your career, all with the hope that it might pay off, and pay off it did. You've talked before about going viral overnight and how that really did change everything, but tell us a little bit about how that happened.
I would travel to London every weekend. It was actually my boss who was my videographer.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like real butterfly effect moments where like certain decisions, if I hadn't made those, I would have never met certain people and would not be sitting here. So it's a bit scary to think about like how I've met people and gotten to where I am today. I would trek with my blue IKEA bags with my stand mixers across from Highgate. He lived in Kilburn, so I'd take like an hour and a half bus, and every weekend we'd film YouTube videos, and they were doing averagely, you know, 600 views, maybe 1,000 views, you know, there was no traffic to them. And this compilation video went gangbusters. Like, I mean, my phone was blowing up overnight, just the most YouTube subscribers in 24 hours of anyone in the world, more than Rihanna, more than Justin Bieber. Like, it was screenshots that I was just thinking, it is this weird, I don't know, validation, this, you know, you kind of crave those numbers on your screen. And again, this was back in, 2015. So yeah, overnight, I really went from, you know, I maybe had, you know, 1,200 followers to probably, you know, total 150, 200K.
Whoa.
Overnight, yeah.
How did the guy who did the video find you?
I don't know. I literally got an email. They specialized in compilation videos. Mm. So they would make, you know, it was big on the time, Facebook compilation videos where they would just take kind of the Lad Bible style. They would take BuzzFeed. They would take all your videos, compile them with a cute little soundtrack and some text. And yeah, I don't know why they picked me. I would love to find, you know, there was a girl who put it together. I would love to find her and shake her hand.
Do you know what? I think that's what happened with Pasta Grannies as well.
Yeah.
That was the catalyst for them exploding.
I mean, it really was. Without her, I don't know where she is today, but I owe her my career for sure.
That level of attention happening so quickly, I mean, I know you've talked in the past about that being an overnight success, but really, I mean, there had been years of hard work to get to that point. It was just then it did happen very quickly. How did that feel to achieve what you'd been setting out to achieve? Did it feel like how you thought it was going to, or did you actually feel quite panicked?
Yeah, I just remember getting a text from my boss and he was like, oh my gosh, have you seen it? I was like, what have I seen? What? I was wondering why my Facebook was going crazy. And I just finally found the video. And what did I feel? Again, at the time, it wasn't a career. I was never doing it to make money. You know, my dream, this is funny, I wanted a free sponsorship from Mason Cash. I wanted like a Mason Cash ceramic bowl. That was like what I wanted to get out of my YouTube channel, for real.
Mad.
I loved their bowls and I really wanted a free Mason Cash bowl.
Well, how much is a bowl worth?
I mean, 40 quid maybe, you know, it wasn't anything crazy.
That was your dream.
Yeah, I really wanted them to send me a free bowl, but it wasn't about money. I mean, even to the point where for the first 4 years of my YouTube channel, I had the monetization turned off. Like, I didn't want to earn money because I knew how annoying ads were and I hated ads and I wanted people just to consume the content. So, I mean, I missed out on some good cash for sure, which is a real shame because I went viral and didn't get a penny for it. But my dream, again, was not to be a baker or an influencer. And so I didn't really know what to do with it. I felt a pressure of, wow, people think I'm good at baking and I'm not. Mm. And that was quite difficult to play catch up and also maintain the views. You know, my videos started getting 80,000, 100,000 views, which on YouTube is a big deal. You know, that is a big number. And it was like, okay, I'm going to start chasing the algorithm. And that was where it went downhill for me. You know, it was like, right, I'm going to look at making a rainbow fondant cake. And that was not what I was interested in, but it was just anything to chase views. I had no strategy. It was all about maintaining that virality. Mm. And that was really kind of my downfall for that, of just, gosh, I've had this success. How do I maintain it? How do I keep it up? And yeah, I didn't.
Yeah. Well, no, unbelievably stressful. Mm. That's just it's not possible to maintain that.
Yeah. And so, that's why I quit in the end. I stopped doing it because it was just not enjoyable. I wasn't particularly good at it. It was a lot of work for not much reward. And I thought, no, I don't want to do this
anymore. I mean, sometimes you have to be on the other side of it to learn that lesson, annoyingly. But so often the thing that you're working towards, once you get it, it doesn't bring you what you were expecting it
to. So yeah, it's this sort of relentless chasing of, which I think I've stopped, I've given up on that. It's so saturated now. That doesn't keep me up at night like maybe it once did.
I think that's why it's obviously a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, that it's why it's so important to enjoy the journey. Because if you are just waiting for that end result, whether that's selling your company or, I don't know, whatever it happens to be, life is going to be quite miserable because you're doing what you're doing every day. And if you're not enjoying it, then what is the point?
Yeah, and I'd say I'm definitely like, still waiting for that moment, but that moment is different to what it was 6 years ago. Like for me, that moment now is, okay, I want that Netflix show, or I want to be the next judge of whatever show. Like that's my next goal. It's not, I need to get to that many followers or that many views. Like I know how saturated it is. I know how long I've been in the game. Like that doesn't satisfy me. Yeah, it's nice. Those viral moments are nice, but they're very fleeting. They're not like they were, you know, seven,
back
8 years
day.
Back in the day. Like it was, you know, overnight you would just get so many followers, and it's just not really like that anymore. And so my mindset has shifted to that, and in just enjoying what I'm doing and chasing other goals and paying my mortgage and supporting my family, and those things are more important to me than looking at other YouTube channels and wishing that I was them.
Definitely. We're on to the fifth desert island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
Can I give you savoury?
Yes.
Okay. So this is a dish I cook in my house regularly, and it's fennel sausage pasta.
Oh, yum.
So I am addicted to fennel sausage pasta. So you just like toasting fennel seeds. You cook off your sausages until they're golden brown. Mm. You can add onions, garlic. I would love to do like orchetti. Sometimes I put cannellini beans in there. Mm. Again, I'm not the most amazing chef. I can definitely cook, but I eat sausage pasta far too many times a week and only probably just realise now that eating like seven sausages a week is actually quite bad.
It is a very easy way to eat quite a lot of sausages.
Yeah, and when they pack them in six pack, it's like, well, three each. And then if you use
they're just crumbled up into tiny little bits.
But when you then use, you know, the fitness tracker app and you're like, my trainer said I was only allowed X amount of fat this week and I've just got over it with just one pasta dish. Yeah. But I am addicted to that for sure.
Are you the cook in your house?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, my wife, she can cook. You know, I'm not going to slate her on the podcast. She can cook. but cooking is not her passion. She's not interested in a meal. And we have a young family, so she does a brilliant job as a mum and as a parent. And so I'm happy to kind of take that role. I mean, yeah, and I'm a bit controlling in baking, and so like I like to just.
I have to say, Matt, I think I'd be scared cooking for you.
No, I think I'm really nice, especially savoury. If you're cooking for me baking, yeah, I might be a little bit scary, no. savoury, though, I don't have a leg to stand on, so I would not be, yeah.
Do you feel like when you go to a friend's for supper, is anyone brave enough to make you a pastry?
Oh, yeah. They make the lemon tart.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
They make the lemon tart.
Well, it's quite fun because when the book came out, I had friends like make the lemon tart as like a nice celebration for the book. I don't have friends that cook. They're not into food. They're not into baking. I really don't have anyone that cooks around me. But so for them, it was, they were like, you know, I had to use 12 eggs in this. And, you know, that's £2.85 on eggs. Or, you know, they were just baffled. Whereas I'm just, you know, smashing out sugar eggs and cream all the time. So I don't even look at the amount. But, you know, them rolling the pastry and chilling it, and it was chaotic. I wonder, you know, it was quite.
That's,
I write recipes quite precisely. I'm wondering how they, but again, they don't have the right tins.
How did you mess this up?
Yeah, how did you mess it up? But you know, they're trying to do it in the middle of summer.
But thank you. It's very sweet, and I'm very touched.
Yes, I was touched, but I was also ruthless. Like, no, you've overcooked it. You split the lemon filling.
We have to talk about some of the creations that you've made, because your baking goes way beyond that of the home baker. You've become quite known for your 3D printing and creating these amazing designs. I'm imagining that your kitchen is half kitchen and half science lab.
It has turned, yeah. My garage is filled with things that I'm wondering why I have them, you know. But yeah, I have this element to my baking, which is design and creativity. And again, when I was growing up, I was not an artist or a designer, or was never into that. But it kind of was born out of the idea of, again, everyone makes the same thing in baking and they use the same mold and it's always the same shape. And I was like, what if I want a different mold? What if I just want to make my own molds? What if I want to come up with a design? And so, you know, desktop vacuum forming machines were born, and I was able to get my hands on one and work with that company and started, you know, I'd start vacuum forming toy blocks from my nieces to make different shapes. Or, you know, I made a 3D bowling ball set once, which was a terrible dessert. But yeah, it was always about just, again, creating something unique, creating something different. I think probably when I started out making my own molds and ideas, it was definitely the creativity first and the recipe second. I think where I'm at now, it is a combination of visuals and recipes, but it is about inspiration. Okay, yeah, I did one about a 3D ice cream cone, which was, looked like a soft serve ice cream cone, which I was really impressed with. That really came out really well. You know, the perfectionist in me was very happy. But again, it was just the creativity. Would it have been the most mind-blowing dessert? I mean, it's big, you know. This is like 7 inches tall with a lot of cream in it. And yeah, I'm not sure it was the most delicious thing ever, but it was fun. It was creative. It was inspiring. And I love that idea of doing something again that no one else has done before.
I wondered, like, do you think that's all part of the self-taught journey that you've been on, where you obviously taught yourself the fundamentals and the basics, and then you went through all the different stages, and now it's like constantly wanting to push yourself for the next challenge?
Yeah, and I think it's part of this being self-taught, trying to differentiate myself, and also, I guess, like laying the groundwork for, you know, I talked about my dream of being a judge or a host or whatever it is. It's like, I want to be the best, and I want them to come to me and be like, wow, this guy could make like a financier or a Madeleine, but he can also 3D print an ice cream cone. Like, he covers all bases. Like, I want to be able to do everything so that they're like, he's the best. And it's, again, that sort of, you know, weird thing of, yeah, trying to make myself feel better about being an imposter. But I love being able to do something that other people can't do. Like, yeah, I can make a wedding cake. Yeah, I can make croissants, but I can also do 3D printing. It's like, I want to differentiate myself. So when my time comes, which I think hopefully it will one day, and I get that show or whatever, it's like, yeah, he's the guy because he can do it all.
It's so interesting because in this interview, I feel like you think being self-taught is a negative. But I think when I was reading about you, I think it's such, it's like, it's a huge selling point. You've taught yourself all of this? And like, to the point where I wondered whether you kind of didn't.
He's lying.
No, to the point where I thought maybe you didn't want to go on a course or whatever, because then you wouldn't be able to say you're self-taught. And it's so impressive.
Yeah, I love saying self-taught, because again, like, I'm trying to inspire home bakers and tell them, like, you can make the perfect lemon tart at home or whatever. And so I love that, like, we can be this army of home bakers. It's like, you can do it better than your local bakery. Not to shut down the local bakeries or anything like that, but just like, you can do it at home to a really good standard. And I'm going to be the one to show you how to do that.
We're on to the sixth desert island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish?
That's a good one. I won't say the sausage pasta, because yeah, I would probably cook that for people. But I do love a big lasagna. That's my like main thing I would cook, because again, I'm a fine cook, but I'm not the most amazing. But this is where I would go to a cookbook. So I would go to like Polpo or something, and I would take like their ragu recipe, and I would make homemade pasta and bechamel, and I might make a homemade garlic dough balls to go with it. So I would make something relatively simple in my mind in lasagna, but I would cook it for 8 hours, and I would try and really follow the steps of a professional.
So you don't do anything by heart.
No, but again, I don't have the time for this necessarily like I used to. Like before I had kids, every Saturday would be like, right, I'm going to try and make lamb shank, or I'm going to try and make... And I had some terrible... Again, I'm not a savoury cook. I had some terrible dishes. My wife and I still laugh about beef stroganoff I tried to make, and it was actually inedible.
Why? What happened to it?
I can't even remember. It was like wild rice. I think it was my dad's recipe, so maybe I blame him, but... I think I used the wrong cut of beef, and it was really tough, and it was too salty, and the wild rice was just, I don't know, wild rice. I haven't had it ever since that day, but everything went wrong, and yeah, I didn't have that experience to fix it or understand where things had gone wrong. So yeah, I don't do these massive meals really anymore. It's like, right, how can I cram as many vegetables into my children as possible and then get them to bed?
When you're having someone round for a dinner party, yes, you're having friends round, what are you cooking for a pudding?
That's a really good question. This is quite bad, but I often go back to a chocolate fondant.
Why is that bad?
It's not the most amazing or technical dessert, you know, considering what I make. They'll be delicious. Like, oh, we saw you made the Chanel cube. Were you serving that at dinner tonight? I'm not going to serve the Chanel cube.
Nobody is going to be disappointed with a chocolate fondant, no, it's surely.
It's usually because I haven't had enough time in the day, and it's something that I can just like... melt butter and chocolate, whip up the eggs, add the sugar, pour the chocolate and the flour in, and then I can just chill it in the fridge. And it only takes me maybe 10, 15 minutes, and I'll do a little quenelle of cream, and they always like the quenelle of cream. So I'll get out the Rocher spoon and do a little Rocher on top. So they like that. That's my little touch of elegance. But it's usually a very basic chocolate fondant, yeah.
I know, but chocolate fondant's one of those things that... we know is actually quite simple to make, but if you haven't made one,
well,
you don't know.
Shall I give you the cheat? Okay.
Tell us, yeah.
If you're worried about it not going right, or you haven't got a good recipe and you're worried about it not being soft in the center, take a Lindt truffle, okay, put that in the batter, pipe the rest of the batter on top, put it in the oven. Whether you overbaked it or not, you're going to have something that oozes out the middle, because the Lindt chocolate truffle will melt. So that is the secret.
That is a top tip, Matt.
They're delicious.
Yes, they're so good. On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. So I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
Okay, so this is not a cookbook I use necessarily, but it is one that I would treasure. So it's a very old book my dad gave to me, which was The Great British Chefs. Very, very old. And it's kind of a collection of recipes from... who were great British chefs at the time. And my dad is in it. And he never wrote a book. Like I said, my dad was kind of slightly ahead of his time. He didn't get a TV show. He didn't write a book. But this is the one book where he actually has a few recipes in. And it's funny looking at them, like how old school they are. The plating. And he has some desserts in there. And he has this strawberry syllabub recipe in there, which again is like so old school, the way he's plated it. But that's quite special for me because... again, he hasn't written a book. I have written a book, which is very lucky. And so to have that kind of connection where we're both authors was really nice. And so that's a book I treasure. But I do have a lot of cookbooks, but that one's very special to me.
Matt, we're on to the final seventh desert island dish. What is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off the desert island?
I think, well, this is since the age of like 18, 16 maybe, again, when I was kind of obsessed with the gym, I've eaten scrambled eggs on toast probably 347 days of every single year.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, genuinely, like, I have scrambled eggs on toast. I didn't have it today, which is devastating. I did run out of time. but I rarely miss a day where I have scrambled eggs or some form of egg on toast. So I would definitely have to have eggs on toast before I
went
away.
Have you got a secret to your scrambled egg?
No, I butcher them. I absolutely murder my eggs. Like, it's all about speed and like eating as quickly as possible. So like,
so you're not fussy.
The pan could be hot, the pan could be cold, like they might be sloppy, they might be overcooked. Like, I don't care. I want them as quickly on my plate as possible. So I make
so bad. You're a perfectionist in everything in your life apart from scrambled eggs.
Yeah. I will say poached eggs I always do perfectly, so 2 minutes 47, you know, I have the timer. So my dad did teach me how to poach. He eats poached eggs a lot, so I did learn how to make poached eggs from him.
Okay.
But scrambled eggs, they're murdered.
Anything goes.
Dry, don't care.
Okay, so we're beginning with scrambled egg on toast.
I mean, genuinely, I think after that, I might have to go for sausage pasta, like I said earlier. Sausage fennel pasta, any kind of pasta. I'd love orecchietti. That would be my go-to shape, if possible.
Mm.
I could even just do like a pesto pasta, but it has to be pasta for sure. Ideally, a side of bread. I'm not sure if a side of soup counts. I'm thinking like Olive Garden. I love soup. So I'd go like bread, pasta, and soup as my main.
Mm-hmm.
Even tomato soup. I mean, again, I'm that basic. I'd have to finish with lemon tart.
It's a classic for a reason.
Yeah. My wife says soup is not a meal, but I love, you know, when I go to a restaurant, I'm like, soup. I want soup to start. But like, soup of the day is tomorrow. I'm like, I don't care. Give me the soup. And then I'd have to finish with lemon tart or ice cream. I love ice cream. Is my, I've got a real crux for ice cream. So like a Ben and Jerry's or Haagen-Dazs vanilla. Yeah. Big fan.
That sounds absolutely
delicious.
Doesn't
work together, but yeah, it was good. It's good for me.
Matt, those were your Desert Island dishes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So there we have it. Another delicious day of Desert Island dishes. Don't forget, you can find me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes, where you'll find snippets from the interviews, a whole lot of recipes, and much more. You can also visit the website desertislanddishes.co, or you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, Dinner Tonight, where I share one easy and delicious weeknight recipe every single week. You can find that at dinnertonight.substack.com. Thank you again to Mould & Salt, our sponsor for this season of Desert Island Dishes, and they enable us to help bring the podcast to you every week. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next week. Bye.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.